Good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Thank you all for being here so promptly. And why don't we start, as always, with introductions. I am Joan Burke from Loaves and Fishes.
I'm Bill Molden, I'm with her.
Right.
You're Patty Klein, connect.
I'm Emily Honk, of City of Saxon.
Patty Klein, connect, River District.
I'm Diane Lampy, and I'm going to take the moment just to say a couple things. I'm with the Sacramento County Office of Education. This is actually going to be my last meeting today. I'm returning to the Elk Grove Unified School District Student Support Centers. I manage two of them, and I will also be a homeless liaison there. That's my district since 2000. We know that right now the board does not have any available seats, and we are really hoping and the Sacramento County Office of Education would hope that once there is room available on the board, that you would invite the SCOE Homeless Liaison, Project Teach Homeless Liaison to apply, or the nominating committee would consider that. We really do feel it's important that education be at the table and would like to continue as the new coordinator is hired.
Diane, thank you very much for your service on this board. It's much appreciated.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
Dan Monk, Sacramento Police Department.
Erin Johansson, TLCS.
David Houston, Cottage Housing.
Cindy Kavanaugh, Sacramento County.
Sarah Bontrager, City of Elk Grove.
John Foley, Sacramento Self-Help Housing.
Lisa Kelsey, Empowerment.
Nick Lee, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Michelle Watts, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Ryan Lucrow, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Ben Avey, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Nick Morey, Sacramento County Public Health.
Robin Rosehammer, next one.
Mike Jaskey, Sacramento Act.
Alexis Bernard, Attorney for Community Progress.
Jeff Tardigia, Advocate, Car, Dogfight, Owl.
Gabrielle Salazar, Sacramento Steps Forward.
John Mellis, with Staff Attorney with Home Base.
Amanda Wehrman with Home Base.
Kate Castorino, Sacramento
School.
Kathy White with the County Office of Ed.
Chris Jensen, Resources
for Independent
Living.
Thank you, Harvard, School
Fox.
Oh,
hi, everybody. And I'm
Emily Bender.
Sorry,
no, it's okay. Emily Bender with the Sacramento LGBT Community Center.
And
Desley.
Hi, Desley Beckman, Sacramento School. Welcome. And now the minutes.
In your packet and online, you have the minutes from our last meeting. We would entertain a motion to accept the proposal offered. We have a move to approve quickly. We have a second.
I'll second.
We do have a second. We have further discussion.
Yeah, when we have things in the minutes where it says they're going to bring back reports or that kind of thing, how does that fit into your agenda for the next meeting, and how do we make sure we don't lose that? I noticed there were two or three things last time in the minutes, and I don't see them necessarily on the agenda this time, but it's not sure how to
call them out, and we'll make sure that we have those things out here.
Sorry, Ryan, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
I would say just call out those items that were not reported back, so make sure that we round that.
But you will incorporate it in the next agenda if you can.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, so we have a motion. We have a second. We have had discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstention for absence? We have one. The motion carries.
Thank you for your
That's
hard work.
Oh my God.
I'd like to ask Chris Jensen from Resources for Independent Living to come up. I'm sure most, if not all of you, are aware that Francis Brace Child, the long-term executive director of Resources for Independent Living, died very unexpectedly recently, and she was a leader in helping those who are homeless, those with disabilities, everyone who is marginalized in any way. So we'd like to present a proclamation to Chris and Resources for Independent Living, and I'd like to read it. A resolution honoring Frances Racechild. Whereas the Sacramento Continuum of Care Advisory Board and the entire community of providers of homeless services lost a valued member and leader on June 5th, 2017, with the death of Frances Racechild. And whereas Frances Racechild served as the Executive Director of Resources for Independent Living, the Sacramento Region's Independent Living Center, since 1981, and was a tireless crusader at the local, state, and national level for the rights and dignity of people with disabilities. And whereas Frances Racechild dedicated her career to advocating for systemic solutions to the root causes of poverty and homelessness, and whereas Frances Racechild's compassion, kindness, and intelligence enrich the lives of everyone fortunate enough to know and work with her. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Sacramento Continuum of Care Advisory Board, on behalf of its members, honors the memory of Frances Racechild, celebrates her legacy of advocacy for people with disabilities and people living in poverty, and recognizes with great appreciation the contributions she made over the course of her career. We would entertain a motion for this resolution.
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And Chris, we'd like to give you this in memory of Frances and feeling very reassured that you will carry on the good work that Frances so excelled at. Thank you very, very much.
Can you say anything? Or?
Sure.
The reason I ask is because I'm in still a bit of emotional shock. Frances had rules, a lot of one-liners, and one of them was, no crying is allowed, R-I-L. And I'm doing my best to abide by that right now, but it's tough. I had the privilege of knowing her and working for her for almost 10 years. I started at RIL in 2007, that's a weird way to say that. But anyway, and I came to the disability rights movement cold. No background, no nothing. I didn't know it existed when I started. She took a chance with me and trained me and mentored me and brought me in as her systems change advocate. I became the director of advocacy services about a year ago. Worked very closely with her and was surprised all the time about who she knew and what she had done. You know, there's some of you are familiar with the Ticket to Work program. Well, she helped start that back in D.C. She was on the panel. She was appointed by Congressman Robert Matsui back in the day to be on that panel, and she would go back and forth from Sacramento to D.C. all the time to get that Ticket to Work program off the ground. It took a long time. And her take on it was always from the consumer's perspective. I mean, everyone's looking at how they can make money off of the program, but really it's about getting money in the pocket of the people that need to go back to work. That was always her emphasis, and she made her mark there. Lots of those people across the country that know who she is. She was reappointed to that panel by, I don't know, a senator or assemblyman, I'm a loss of it, Dick Gephardt. Reappointed her to the panel. They thought they had finally gotten rid of her. And lo and behold, he reappoints her, and it was to the chagrin of many members on that panel. Because Frances, if you knew Frances, you knew she was complicated, and she gave no ground. Whether she was right or wrong, she gave no ground. And I know that RIL has been a part of the COC for a very long time. And some of you know me, some of you don't, but you probably would know Anson more than myself. I asked him to come, he was going to come, and then last night I asked him, I said, what is your, you know, are you coming or not? And he
He sends his regrets that it's still a bit too close. We're managing, and we thank you very much for this. Evan, her nephew, is the Independent Living Center Executive Director in Chico, and he's handling all the affairs. And I emailed Joan last night. We have a time and place and date and all that stuff for a memorial. It's going to be on July 7th, so there's plenty of time to prepare. I started letting people know all the details, and then Evan said, you know, he really wants to do some type of an RSVP thing, so we can get a handle on the number of folks that really want to go, because it's probably going to be a lot. I'm sorry I'm not giving you all the details today, but I'm going to continue letting Joan know, and I'm sure that you'll pass any information along. I was going to say one more thing. Frances was on medical leave for a while, and I went to visit her in the hospital. And she looks at me and she says, I have a question for you. And I'm like, well, what's the question? And she says, well, how would you feel if we appointed you as the interim executive director while I'm out? And I looked at her and I said, what, do you hate me? Is that it? Which was actually a joke, right? And I said, I do whatever you want me to do. Fully expecting her to return. And now the game has changed a bit. I don't know what the future holds exactly, but good things, I'm sure, especially with the support of the folks around the table here that have been partners with RIL for a very, very long time. So once again, thank you. I have no idea what this means, and I'll be sure to let Evan know and family will know.
Thanks. Thank you, Chris.
I figured all that.
It's
not signed yet.
Okay. Meanwhile, why don't we go on to the Brian's report?
I'm going to report out that we've had meetings over at the county, and they're looking at their budget currently, so we're still keeping an eye on that, see how things are playing out. And then had the pleasure joining the City of Sacramento with the Whole Person Care Act press conference, and then last night approval for receiving those dollars, and then we're looking forward to working with Emily and the team over there as we look at the system we've developed for HUD dollars and now for locally used dollars for frequent users. So it's exciting to see our community grow and watch the evolution of coordinated entry and what that means both locally and then as we manage the national dollars. So.
And I would just like to add, we should take a moment and recognize the Red Letter Day that occurred yesterday when the county allocated additional millions of dollars, if they pass the budget, which we trust they will, to address homelessness, and the city voted to accept the Whole Person Care Act. Cindy and Emily, is there anything you'd want to add?
I'm sorry. It might be helpful for us to actually present to this group at some point an overview of the initiative.
Absolutely.
Because it's hard to read those long reports, and so we'd be happy to do that, but we look forward to working with all of you. We are scheduling meetings and interviews, et cetera, to fill out the details of the, especially the two new initiatives. So we'd just like to say we look forward to implementation, and we'll be working really hard over the next 6 months. Both will launch in early 2018, the two initiatives.
And I would concur, I think, thanks for a lot of you guys who helped us, because it was not a small lift to get the application in. Certainly there's a lot of work to be done in the next 6 months, and I think that would also maybe be to the extent that the advisory board is interested to share a little more about whole person care, what it means and what it is, and how we envision it complementing the system here. So. I think to Cindy's point, it's probably more than just if they're interested in having to do that.
Well, let's put it on next month. You
know, we can do that. I'm just wondering, there's so much work that happens here at the advisory board that maybe we schedule a meeting specific to this.
Yes, we don't agree.
And I guess I'd just like to suggest that we do that always. You know, for the, because, you know, the presentation we had last month was kind of unexpected and sort of out of order and took a lot of time. So I think it would be good to give these kinds of things the attention that they're due.
Yeah. And speaks to, John, your point earlier about report backs. I mean, when we sat down and looked at what it is that has to be done here, to think that we're going to have a lot of report backs and still have enough time to get the work done, this isn't realistic. And so we acknowledge that.
Thank you. And now the HUD NOPA ranking. Good morning, everyone. We are back today with the fiscal year 2017 COC NOPA competition material. So that is the renewal project scoring tool, extended project scoring tool, and the policy or process document that covers how we conduct the review and rank. These materials were developed over several meetings of the Performance Review Committee, and this advisory board also provided a great deal of feedback at last month's meeting with some specific direction to go back and edit a couple items within the tool and process. So you'll see that input reflected in the changes made to these final documents. They do need to be approved today in preparation for the release of the NOFA, which could be any time. And once that NOFA drops, we have a pretty tight timeline to run through our process. So keeping those things in mind, I'm going to hand it over to John from Homebase to walk us through the docking. So,
thanks, Michelle. So just to reintroduce myself, I'm John Mellis. I'm one of the staff attorneys with Homebase. You all saw me about 2 months ago at this point in time talking about these tools. I'm joined today by Amanda, and she has done a lot of work here in Sacramento in the past as well, and is just coming along to provide her own unique input and perspective on these tools and kind of the Homebase process and how we develop these scoring tools and processes and policies. To orient you to the materials, this salmon-colored page is a change log that summarizes what we've done with the scoring tools and policies since the last meeting, and also since 2016 for the policies, since we didn't really touch on those too much last meeting. The pink handout is the new project scoring tool, and the green handout is the renewal project scoring tool. And finally, the goldenrod handout, or yellow, is the policies and procedures and process, essentially, for the 2017 competition itself. Before I launch into kind of talking about these tools and how we, what changes we made, I just wanted to make a quick point about how we got here today. Michelle pointed out that we've been spending, you know, I want to say a good 6 months, almost to a year, really looking at each one of these factors in depth with the Performance Review Committee, taking the information we have from HMIS, taking the information that we have from various sources to really develop each one of these factors and make sure that they meet the needs of folks experiencing homelessness here in Sacramento. And I think the Performance Review Committee has done an excellent job of looking at all this information and really having tough conversations about what we want this tool to look like and how it reflects the Sacramento community. So I do want to recognize the efforts of the PRC in creating this tool and really being willing to engage with the data we have and have those tough conversations about what is going to best serve the needs of Sacramento with this funding stream. And I know Sarah and Emily will kind of chime in as we're presenting these tools and can provide additional information about what the PRC was considering and thinking about as we developed all of these materials. So in terms of the renewal and scoring tool, and again, this is the pink and green handouts. The first main point is the community needs factor, or I should say set of factors. They are the same for both tools. And this was something that at the last meeting we had discussed that the PRC still needed to put in once we got additional data about our community needs and gaps analysis. And we received that data from ABT. And that information suggested that Sacramento does need permanent supportive housing for folks who are experiencing chronic homelessness. And the PRC looked at that information, discussed it,
so
and
is
decided...
there a gaps analysis or something that we could... What are you talking about?
ABT is a consultant we're using right now that's developed a gaps analysis. On June 20th, we had a meeting with the county and city's SHRA and others to really look at the assumptions that were made and the gaps as they are currently. There is a early report that was produced that was for this committee to review to make decisions. But it will be made available to this group to vet through the larger report. But there was a specific portion of it that was used by this committee to make decisions.
And it was very summary, I would add.
So without seeing it, how do we actually say it's a community need? I think that's a little bit what you're asking.
So I think what you'll see with the tool is that the gaps analysis did not play into the tool development quite as much as a full gaps analysis would have. The data on it was very limited. There were two subpopulations that were studied. It was veterans and...
Transition age group.
Yes. And so it didn't quite go through kind of all the subpopulations that we would have liked. And we understand that ABT is still working on it. So we did what we could with the limited data available for this.
So can you explain how will you explain how this was determined to be the gap then as part of this
Absolutely.
Discussion?
Yeah. Okay. So the analysis that ABT used identified that, like most communities, there is a need for permanent supportive housing. And I think what the Performance Review Committee really took from that as well is the fact that the mid-year review rank indicated there was an issue in terms of identifying the need in Sacramento for single-site or built permanent supportive housing projects, that the mid-year tool did not really reflect that need in Sacramento overall as a community. And so that's why you see the 3 points in there specifically for built single-site projects, because the Performance Review Committee recognized that was a strong need here in Sacramento. The tool also...
That's not really what the deal... The deal was we were afraid Diversity was going to lose the funding for their, you know, for their projects, right? It's not that we need more, exactly.
So you have to consider it when it's... You don't want to lose what's existing.
Yeah, right.
That was a lot of the committee's discussion was about, you know, right now it's very difficult to find new options in rapid rehousing and for permanent supportive. It's just very difficult, and so we wanted to award points to those built projects.
Exactly. Primarily existing. This conversation was not about new necessarily. It was about the existing, preserving the existing built units we have.
Yeah. And so that tool and scoring factor reflects that with the 3 additional points. There's 6 points for projects that provide permanent housing, whether it's permanent supportive housing, rapid rehousing, or the still, as of yet, somewhat undefined transitional housing, rapid rehousing hybrid project that HUD has proposed in its notice. We'll get more details on that project type once the actual notice of funding availability is provided to communities. And then finally, there's 6 points for projects which address chronic homelessness. And this factor is meant to not be just merely a, oh yes, we address chronic homelessness, we check a box and receive full points. Projects in their narratives and as part of the local application and request for information will need to describe the specific elements that they have designed within their programs to serve individuals who are experiencing chronic homelessness, recognizing that persons who experience chronic homelessness have long periods of homelessness and often have a severe disability. So project design will need to meet that, and projects will also have to dedicate a certain amount of their beds in order to receive the full points on this scoring factor. Specifically, projects will have to dedicate or prioritize 100% of turnover beds for chronically homeless individuals in order to receive the full 6 points. If they prioritize between 50 and 100% of their turnover beds for folks experiencing chronic homelessness, they'll receive 3 points. And if they have 49.9 or below in terms of turnover beds prioritized for persons experiencing chronic homelessness, they will not receive points on the scoring factor. So that was the factor that was designed by the Performance Review Committee for both the new and the renewal scoring tool to match what the information was that we had in terms of community needs and the gaps analysis. And again, I think that was informed by that information and also by the discussion of the providers and the non-conflicted members of the PRC, knowing the Sacramento community and knowing what the Sacramento community needs to preserve the services that are most important for folks experiencing homelessness here in this community.
Can I ask you a question?
I think I
understand this, but last time we had a big conversation about the legacy folks, maybe some programs that have a lot of people who
wouldn't meet that chronic homeless definition. Mm-hmm. And you're just talking about the new people moving in, now you're not.
Correct. Yeah, so in terms of the chronic homelessness factor, we're looking prospectively. So if you anticipate having 10 turnover beds, if you dedicate or prioritize 100% of those beds for folks experiencing chronic homelessness, and you have adequate program design that suggests to the Performance Review Committee that you are going to be able to actually serve their elevated needs, then you would receive the full points on that scoring factor.
Do you want us to ask questions as we go, or per section?
Yeah, we do.
That's appropriate. Okay. Yeah, that's kind of how we've been doing it. It seems like it generates good discussion. Yeah.
But I think it is helpful to ask questions.
It just seems this is probably the biggest, newest item. And I do have to say I'm a little confused on what it's based on. Not data, it sounds like, basically. Not data on programs or who's being, you know, what the gaps are, I guess I would say.
So I will say that the gaps analysis that we got showed the very highest need for more permanent supportive housing. And so that piece absolutely is based on the gaps analysis. The region is definitely underserved by PSH.
Then my question would be, why is number one, what does it exclude? It seems to include permanent housing. I don't see something that's just for permanent supportive housing. And I don't know, there may be good reason, but what does it exclude? Which type does it exclude?
Transitional. Mm-hmm.
Just plain transitional. Yeah, but it doesn't really prioritize permanent supportive housing,
correct,
if I'm reading it right.
It prioritizes permanent housing, yes.
So what the highest need was permanent supportive housing.
There were more permanent supportive housing units needed than rapid rehousing, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also a conversation about, to be frank, the quality of the data in the gaps analysis, because it excluded, for example, all of the new SHRA units that have been dedicated but not online yet. It also had some strange numbers that nobody in the room could make sense of in the moment because we didn't have the backup about some certain subpopulations. So, I mean, I think Sarah is right that was like sort of the immediate, you know, it was literally like one table that we got. It wasn't like we got to dig in deep to the data. And so at base, that's what it appeared to be. But there was so many questions about the data at the back end that we didn't, I say, I didn't think that I felt that we could put all the weight in that.
Also, I think that this responded to some of the discussion we had last time about how certain subpopulations got extra points at other subpopulations that didn't get extra points that would then be penalized. And so I think that's where this came from, wasn't it, that we talked about that?
Yeah.
It was really about the populations, not the type of housing so much.
And there was very little data on subpopulations.
Yeah.
Right. Pretty much not. I mean,
yeah.
There wasn't data on all of them, which
right,
is what we would have needed,
yes,
to
there you go,
make those determinations.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that as we dig into that gaps analysis and as we get more information, we can begin to roll in that very subpopulation-specific focused information for that scoring tool. And that was something the PRC is excited to engage in over the next, you know, 6 months before our next mid-year review, for example. But I think, you know, and the information that ABT was relying on was information coming from HMIS, was coming from the community queue. So in terms of getting that overall housing stock and saying, well, do we need more transitional housing versus permanent housing options, that information is informed by a lot of Sacramento's needs currently in terms of the data that we have from HMIS and from that community queue. So permanent versus transitional housing, there was definitely, I think the PRC recognized, clear evidence that we needed that permanent housing in the community, which is why this factor prioritizes that.
I'm a little confused on the data subjective. I get either one, but if you have data, can you share it so we know what it's informed by?
Right.
I'm hearing you say it was based on evidence, not data, and I'm hearing, sure, a little bit more nuanced from Sarah and Emily.
Sure.
Which was...
And I think it's a combination of both. In terms of identifying that need of transitional housing versus permanent housing, that was definitely informed by what we were getting from the ABT analysis. And then in terms of that subpopulation information and that built need for built projects, that was definitely informed by community need.
So can you share the data that you have, I guess, is that appropriate to share?
Yeah, and I think Michelle's in the process of creating that report and will be presented to the community soon here, hopefully. I think, Brian,
yeah,
you were saying.
I think part of the challenge was some of the point-in-time information is informing the data that we have now that we're not releasing until July 5th.
Sure.
I think that was part of the challenge. So, and the full analysis of the point in time count just isn't complete yet from the Sac State. So I'm not, I don't have it at my desk. I think some people think I'm just holding on to it to torture everyone. I literally don't have it. We have raw data that's been put out, but it needs to be analyzed. Otherwise, it's this on a community level, looking at raw data without any explanation.
We want, I mean, the intent of the gaps analysis, and we were able to provide a little bit of information for the Performance Review Committee for 2017's review tool, but the point of the process and the intent is a community-wide engagement in where the data came from, the assumptions built into what it predicts is needed around modeling, and it really isn't a complete gaps analysis until that community process happens. So that's what John is referring to in terms of the next 6 months engaged process.
Would it also be fair to say that it's not so much that the data revealed not a need for transitional housing, but the data, but HUD is not prioritizing transitional housing, so therefore, as a HUD continuum, we're not prioritizing transitional housing. So it's not so much about the gaps analysis between those two things. I mean, I understand that the need for more permanent supported housing, absolutely. I don't think we even needed data for that. We know that. But that's not the need. That's not the gap to say that we don't need transitional housing. Saying we're not prioritizing it.
Gaps analysis actually literally said we had too much transitional housing.
How is that possible? Yeah, I don't see how that's.
Easy. Well, because the Mather project is huge, maybe because that's. Yeah.
It's a disproportionate share.
Yeah, maybe.
And the version I saw also said we had too much, enough shelter. So I think the whole community process is really important because the assumptions that go into it.
Yeah.
Let's adjourn.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think that part of our discussion is that we knew that those assumptions hadn't been vetted, and that when that discussion happens, what we saw is likely to not be the end result. So it was. We knew that conversation was coming and that there's probably going to be a lot of input and questions and changes potentially. And so, you know, what we saw was it was fine, but I'm expecting it's going to change.
Yeah.
Well, but the key conclusion that we need more permanent supportive housing probably, or more permanent housing in general is not going to change.
Permanent housing. Yeah. Permanent housing.
Which is why the PRC felt comfortable putting that into the tool. So that, again, factor goes for the new tool. That was the only addition to the new tool since last time. For the renewal tool, there was two elements that we discussed and clarified. The first of which isn't necessarily reflected on the tool itself, but it has to do with how the tool is interpreted in regards to individuals who have passed away in a project. The question was, what do we do with those individuals in terms of how do we count them for the metric measuring permanent housing outcomes? Do they count as being permanently housed? Do they not? So we dug into that, and HUD has very clearly spoken and said, for your system performance measures, for your HMIS data quality standards, individuals who pass away in a project get removed from that calculation entirely. So when you're asking, what were my permanent housing outcomes, and I served 10 people over a given year, if one of them passed away, for that metric specifically, you only serve 9 people for that outcome. So that is how that will be calculated moving forward. And how the Performance Review Committee will analyze those projects in the actual competition. The other factor that we looked at was the data, how we're going to look at our data quality plan. And I noticed that from the minutes as a follow-up action item. So we dug into that more in terms of, well, what is HUD really looking for and what does HUD want at the end of the day? The specific 3-day timeline is not actually required by HUD rules and regulations. HUD asks that for that timeliness factor that that's developed through a community process and it's eventually implemented by the community based off of community needs and expectations. I have seen date ranges ranging from 3 days, 2 days, 7 days, depending on project type. There's a lot of variance there. So in recognition of that, and in recognition of the fact that HUD does care about your data quality, that HUD does want you to have 5% less, 5% or less of null or missing values, which means that your data is essentially 95% accurate. And that was recently captured in the system performance measures that we all had to submit at the beginning of May. That was what the Performance Review Committee really wanted to focus on for this continuum of care competition. So that's why on page 2 of the green handout, And just so you understand how I write these things, strike-throughs indicates information that's been removed. Underline indicates information that has been added. And if you have an actual color copy, that'll be strike-throughs in red, information added in blue. But that scoring factor has been restyled to say that the agency enters accurate information into HMIS, and that the agency will receive full points if they have equal to or less than 5% null or missing values in HMIS for demographic information.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, sure.
The way you characterize it is definitely different than I would characterize it. I would say that, yes, we care about this, but actually what we care about is that the data quality plan is followed, but we didn't want to recreate the data quality plan by the PRC. And so this was a compromise, recognizing that over the next year or 6 months, SF will ensure that the data quality plan is actually what our community wants and needs, and that it can be followed, because we were almost creating exceptions to the data quality plan by the scoring tool, which didn't seem appropriate. So I think that this is a compromise. I say this is not actually what we wanted. This is a compromise, recognizing that the data quality plan is currently not widely used or has some questions, needs to be amended, whatever it is, but the PRC isn't aware of that, and the amendment should take.
Yeah, thank you for that clarification, for sure. This was definitely another one of those items that we discussed at length at the last meeting about how to use this data quality moving forward. So those are the only changes from last time, and we discussed the tools pretty in-depth at the last advisory board meeting. I would like to be able to make sure we touch on the policies and procedures. In summary, the process document really is meant to clarify how the process works from a provider perspective. One of the things that we did after the mid-year review and rank was have a lot of meetings with the provider community who participated in the mid-year review and rank, and one of the biggest points of feedback we got was we're unclear as to what is due when, and we feel like we need more time to be able to review the materials that are utilized during the review and rank process. And so these policies and process are really meant to clarify what that timeline is, make sure that that timeline is clear to all of the participants in the COC competition, and that the expectations for that competition are specifically articulated in black and white so that everybody knows essentially what the rules of the competition are. In terms of substantive changes about what projects are eligible to appeal, things like that, we preserved a lot of that from 2016. So those mechanics are all still in place. The major change in terms of 2016 to 2017 is 2016 used to have automatic triggering conditions for reallocation. And so it said that if you received, it was 45 out of 71 points is what the old scale was, that you automatically had to be reallocated as a project, and that if you had 54 points or less, then you were recommended for reallocation. That language has been removed from the 2017 competition. In recognition of the fact that we want to make sure that all projects are able to compete and that reallocation should be informed by community need and priorities rather than a raw points reallocation. On top of that, we also changed a little bit in terms of the process for voluntary reallocation. So in the old process, if I voluntarily reallocated my funds, the procedure said you would basically be, and voluntarily reallocated to a new project that was more in line with HUD priorities, that new project would be funded. It wouldn't be guaranteed a place in the ranking, but it would be funded. And HUD recently has come out and said that kind of language would necessarily bias renewal projects essentially to new projects, and that all projects should really be ranked based off of their performance and their ability to present a valid project design. So what we've done in the new tool is add an additional 3 points that says that if you are voluntarily reallocating your funds to a project type that more aligns with HUD priorities, that you will receive 3 bonus points for your project. The other caveat to that is that the project remains in the same organization. So if I am John's Permanent Supportive Housing, I have to voluntarily reallocate within my own agency. I can't voluntarily allocate and give my money to someone else. So now the tools and the policies clarify that you will receive bonus points, but that it's not a guarantee of funding. So new projects, even if they're being voluntarily reallocated, still need to demonstrate a high quality and program design, and it opens the door that if there is a new project that may even be better aligned with HUD priorities than the project choosing to voluntarily reallocate, that project may be funded over the project who is choosing to voluntarily reallocate. The other major clarification, and this came from our discussion at the PRC last time.
That's why you wanted to do it that way?
Yeah. Again, it aligns more with the guidance coming from HUD, that HUD basically says that new projects and renewal projects all need to be scored on the same scale, and that no preference can be given to renewal projects over new projects. And so having a policy that says if you're a renewal who is essentially voluntarily reallocating, but you are guaranteed that funding, from our perspective, HUD may still decide that if you're at the bottom of Tier 2, they'll take your funding. But that from the Sacramento perspective, you are guaranteed that funding, that gave an unfair advantage to essentially renewal projects who are voluntarily reallocating, mm-hmm. as opposed to new projects who are coming into the COC.
But I think the reason we did it was to encourage people
to reallocate.
To reward them, to make it attractive, and mm-hmm. this might...
True, and that's why we got the balance there with those three additional bonus points for projects that are voluntarily reallocating in their new project application. So there is still an incentive for projects to voluntarily reallocate, and from what we see in the COC, most renewal projects are pretty much in line with what HUD is looking for, so it would be surprising if there is a project that thinks they would want to voluntarily reallocate to a project type that is more in line with HUD's priorities at this point in time. But that nonetheless, there are those 3 points there should a project choose to do that.
I guess that was, maybe this is the same question you have, I don't know, but it seems to give the bonus points only if and only if the reallocation is staying with the same agency.
Correct.
Seems a little constricting, because what if I have a project that's not performing well, I want to reallocate, and I think John's the better person to run whatever it is that I'm reallocating because his projects are more in line with whatever we as a group decide. So it seems to me it would have been better served to say that the COC made the decision of the, like if the project was in line with what the COC wanted, that's where the bonus points would go, as opposed to only if the agency kept it themselves.
Sure. So the issue there, and I get what you're saying there in terms of getting that local buy-in and the community needs and priorities, the problem that HUD would have with that is that they would say at that point in time, you're no longer ranking a project based on its performance. You're basically ranking a project on subjective community need. And HUD is very much trying to get away from that with all of its data-informed approaches and the system performance measures. So the idea of saying we're going to reallocate funding but guarantee it to another project closes the door to any other new project who would be able to access those reallocated funds. So the idea is that a project reallocates or voluntarily puts up its funds for reallocation, and it's allowed to apply, another organization's allowed to apply for those funds, but they will be judged as well as every other new project in terms of getting that funding. So that's kind of, again, that balance there. And I do recognize that it is a balance.
You would automatically get it if he was the best.
Yeah, okay.
So,
you just don't get the bonus points for doing it. That's the problem.
Yeah. So in terms of the big other item here, this is on page 3 of that salmon handout. The PRC last time really discussed this issue of how subjective versus objective do we want the scoring process to be. Okay? And it's a great question, because you do have these scales, and you do have these binary yes or no's in terms of how you receive points. And so we discussed it with the PRC, and I guess Emily, unfortunately, has had to leave, so Sarah, feel free to jump in. But, you know, the PRC really looked into this and said, you know, we do want to recognize that there are projects who do great work who may have extenuating circumstances that would have reduced their score or otherwise affected their score. And so we as the PRC, as the board that is reviewing these projects, wants to have a little bit of room to be able to adjust those scores up and down from that specific scaled score. Or in the case of some of these other ones that are binaries, for example, that data quality measure, it says, you know, you either get 2 points or you get 0 points. So the way we've written it into the policies, and let me get it to you in the goldenrod handout as well, which is on page 7 of that goldenrod handout. The languaging basically says that the review and rank committee may adjust a objective score by up to 15% of that score's total. You can't exceed the score, and you can't go into negative values. But the review committee does have the authority to either adjust that score up or down, depending on what the project has provided in terms of information explaining that score. A good one that I use as an example typically in my communities is utilization. So sometimes you have a project that is supposed to serve 10 beds over the course of a year. One of their units burns down or suffers flooding, and so they've had lower than their 100% occupancy. They can provide that in a narrative. They can provide it in a phone interview as part of the review and rank process. And then the panel has the discretion to determine whether or not they would like to increase that score or decrease that score based on the project's response to accommodate that unforeseen circumstance or issue there. And so the panel really wanted to have that flexibility to be able to accommodate those kinds of circumstances that aren't reflected in that objective data. The decision has to be documented, and the reason for the decision has to be documented. And that will be made available to the projects at the end of the review and rank process prior to the appeal so that they can bring that up on appeal potentially. And the 15%, it's also rounded to the nearest half point. So if 15% would have allowed you to only do 0.15 of a point, it would be rounded up to the half point. So the panel would be able to adjust up or down by a half point. So for example, on that 2-point scale, it would be a half point, because that would be below that half point.
Can we do this retroactively?
Can you give an example of why it would decrease based on a subjective factor? I don't think it's based on the application.
Sure.
The applicant saying, here's why you should decrease my point.
Right. This is true. In terms of that decrease, there have been times that I've seen in review ranks where a project applicant may provide one answer in their written materials, in their application materials, and then they provide a different explanation as part of their phone interview. And so I have found that review and rank panels have found that to be surprising and have seen that is an indication that the project may not necessarily have its capacity together, for example, on that specific issue. One of them being budget. I've seen that a lot where projects will say, in our written materials, our audit says that, we've got these kind of findings and there's an issue there. But then in their phone interview, they say, no, we have no findings. Everything is fine. What are you talking about? So in terms of those score factors about, do you have agency capacity to be able to operate these programs? I have seen review and rank panels reduce a score based off of that. You're right, though, it is typically rare. So that's how that subjectivity was worked out by the PRC, and I think it's a good compromise, and it creates a clear expectation as to what the PRC's or the review and rank committee's obligations are. The providers know how far up or down their score can be modulated based off of what the scoring factor is. And it still allows for that community-informed decision based off of the materials provided by the provider to make those kind of scoring adjustments. Any questions on that specifically? Anything to add, sir? Great, thanks. So that, I think, in essence, is the major changes to the policies and procedures. To walk through just as a summary of what the process looks like, what we're doing right now is we've solidified the date range that we have in HMIS for your objective performance-based criteria. It's going to be the same as the mid-year review and rank. So it'll be April 1st, 2016 to March 31st, 2017. So projects will spruce up their data, make sure that is accurate, and they'll be evaluated based on that data for those things like returns to homelessness, utilization, connection to mainstream benefits, things along those lines. That information is all going to be put into our reporting system, which is called Presto, which creates basically a one-sheet report the review committee uses to score projects. That will then be provided to the providers at what's called a TA workshop or bidders conference, where essentially the rules of the competition are explained to all the providers. The NOFA is explained to the providers. If there's any unique elements to it, they will get that information at that point in time. Providers will then have 2 weeks to fill out what's called the local application. That's where you get all your subjective answers, your narrative responses, things like our utilization is low because one of our units burned down. We then incorporate that into the Presto report, get feedback from the providers, make sure all that's accurate within that 2-week window. Providers will have 3 weeks to provide us with their eSNAPS application materials, which is the kind of digital information that you submit to HUD, which is also used in the review and rank process. All that information is compiled and then presented to the review and rank committee in usually week 4 or 5. The review and rank committee meets usually over the course of 2 days, given the amount of projects that we have in Sacramento. They provide their scoring recommendations along with any sort of documented reasons for why there's those scoring disparities or why they made certain reallocation decisions. And at the end of the day, that is then put out to the providers. Providers will then have the opportunity to appeal those decisions based off of specific criteria, which are outlined here in the process and mirror that same criteria we presented last year in 2016. After the appeals process is complete, that list of recommended scoring decisions and prioritization is provided to this body for final approval, and it will then be incorporated into the actual consolidated application and submitted to HUD as the final part of that process. Any questions on that? I think most of the providers are pretty familiar with that process, and we're all pretty familiar with it. Yeah.
Will there be an opportunity to review the final packet submitted to the Performance Review Committee prior and with enough time to make?
Absolutely. So at that TA conference, after we've completed it the day after, I will send you your APR report that was given to me by Sacramento Steps Forward, as well as the draft presser report that contains all of that information. Because one of the points of feedback we got was, you know, looking at your APR, it's hard to really tell whether or not your numbers are accurate. For those of you who are not providers who have to deal with this thing called the annual performance report from HUD, it's a lot of numbers and it's hard to crunch it and make sure that everything looks right. So the presser report does that. And it makes sure that it takes all your numbers and puts it into an easy-to-read percentage that can be understood by normal people rather than data junkies. And so that report will be given to the providers on day one. So you have a week to review that and make sure all that information is correct. Then if there is some sort of issue that needs to be changed, we change that during week two. Then we make sure that all that information is correct before locking it down. And then after that two-week period, providers for this year will be able to directly enter their information into our Presto database for those narratives. So you'll be able to fill that out directly. We'll then create a new report and send that to the providers with those narrative responses, make sure that everything looks clean and correct, and that will be in that last two-week window before the review and rank committee meets. So essentially there's 2 weeks to review that objective APR data and make sure that's correct, make sure that everybody's calculating the right way. And then there's another 2 weeks to make sure that all the narrative responses are input cleanly, clearly, typos are removed. If there's formatting issues, we can take care of that then, so that it's clear to the review and rank panel what's being presented and that the programs are accurately presented. I think that was really, you know, one of the things we took away from that mid-year process was there needed to be more time to really make sure this information was accurately presented to the review and rank panel. So yeah, thank you for that.
Will the review and rank panel be looking at the mid-year at all, or no?
So the mid-year review and rank, these scores are all part of a fresh slate. We're using the same data.
Right.
So for things like connection to mainstream benefits, utilization, stuff like that, if you had issues in terms of your data quality, that will be spruced up and accurate for the actual competition, but it will not reflect whether or not you've, in the intervening 2 months or so, 2 to 3 months, have gotten more people connected to mainstream benefits and things like that.
So you will be re-pulling the APR data.
Correct. Yeah, we'll be pulling new APRs, we'll be using that fresh data. So we do encourage you, if you're a project, and we're going to send out a formal email to say, get that data spruced up and ready to go, because the NOFA is rapidly approaching. Any other questions? Oh, sorry, yes.
No, just asking about that.
Sure.
But any idea when it's going to drop? Because I'll tell you what, Cheyenne's dying to go on vacation.
I know.
And I'm like, Cheyenne, go on your vacation. So
yeah.
I'm just...
No, absolutely. It's a great question, and one I wish I could answer confidently, but unfortunately I have to get my sort of, you know, my spiel. Yeah, you know, so it's... We obviously don't know when it's going to come down the pipeline. I cannot say for certain if it's going to come out tomorrow, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, whatever it might be. I can tell you that we recently received some communication from a HUD field office rep who has been talking about another project that needs to make some changes to their grant in terms of how it's categorized in their grant inventory worksheet, technical thing. But the HUD rep's specific language was, we need to get this done soon because the NOFA is coming out soon. So I don't know if that means 2 weeks. I don't know if that means a week. It's, you know, drink your tea and look at the leaves. Drink your tea and look at the leaves, and you might have as good of an idea as I do. But the languaging does have a sense of urgency to it. What that really means at the end of the day, I unfortunately cannot tell you. Believe me, I too was looking for vacation opportunities and would love to know so that I could go ahead and make those plans as well. But as soon as it comes out, we will let you know to make sure that is good to go. And I think the other thing as well with that is we will also make it clear what that time window is. The policies and procedures kind of assume a very accelerated timeline that HUD's not going to give us a lot of time because, as I like to say, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. If HUD, you know, they often say they want to do a 3-month NOFA process. If that were the case, some of these timelines could be expanded to accommodate more changes by providers and making sure that information is accurate in our database. So we will inform everyone about what that timeline looks like and work very closely with Sacramento Steps Forward to make sure that information is disseminated clearly and that, you know, the policy specifically say there will be an official timeline, and that official timeline will be released at that TA workshop when we begin the NOFA process, and that will clearly articulate when things are due and what the consequences are if things are late and things like that. So, yeah.
I want to go back to make sure that we understand,
sure,
or I understand, the impact of the alignment with community needs number 3.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 6 points available for turnover beds to chronically homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about that, I'm assuming that's then for most appropriate for permanent supportive housing. It's not really how you want to align rapid rehousing or even transitional housing. So is that where permanent supportive housing is prioritized? What is my reading of the impact of that accurate, or are you trying to incentivize all kinds of activities to prioritize permanent supportive housing?
Yeah, we are trying, I think the PRC, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah, is trying to prioritize all activities for that chronically homeless group. However, it is recognized that rapid rehousing may not necessarily be the best fit for chronically homeless populations. That transitional housing, rapid rehousing component may be able to address that. Again, more kind of information on that as it becomes available through the NOFA. The scoring factor does tend to drift more towards permanent supportive housing for that element, which recognizes that you do need a higher level of service intervention for persons experiencing chronic homelessness. How that will play out in the competition, I'm not really sure. Programs do need to describe what their plan is for serving chronically homeless individuals. So it could very well be that they're a permanent supportive housing project, but they don't necessarily serve chronically homeless individuals. So they may not necessarily receive these programs.
So just to get to the conversation part amongst us, is that what we want to do? Do we want to actually tell rapid rehousing projects it's better if you prioritize chronically homeless individuals? I know we make it available and we do referrals, but do you want them actually to dedicate slots? And I guess I don't know what transitional rapid rehousing is, but my assumption is if people need more, they need more. So did we talk about that, or do we want to talk about that? And I'm actually looking to the group.
Sure. One other quick element that kind of plays into that. HUD, in terms of promulgating its written standards for prioritization in terms of how COC should prioritize their beds, does ask that COCs prioritize individuals experiencing chronic homelessness over other populations. That is in their most recent notice as well that came out at the end of last year in terms of that prioritization.
For permanent supportive housing.
For individuals who are experiencing chronic homelessness, for all housing types.
That they that you prioritize in rapid rehousing. I've never heard that. Chronically homeless?
No.
I've never heard that.
That wouldn't be a very successful outcome then. So if you were running rapid rehousing and you put chronic homeless in it, you probably the next year would be eliminated because your outcome would stink.
Crap.
Yeah, and it's also not it also penalizes youth programs because youth programs are not generally at housing chronically homeless youth in rapid rehab.
We can prioritize chronically homeless though, and when we run out, so to speak, of chronically homeless, then we would move on. But I think the point around rapid rehousing not being a successful intervention for chronically homeless folks is.
It does put us between a rock and a hard place in terms of, like you say, housing chronically homeless people and getting penalized for a length of stay that exceeds 24 months.
And I'll just add one thing that HUD is encouraging communities to do is to really be creative about how they're using Raptor housing, and especially in the context of coordinated entry, and just trying to make sure that we aren't creating a system where we have a bunch of folks scoring in a permanent supportive housing range that are languishing because they're not at the top of your PSH list, but they're kind of too high a level of acuity for your Raptor housing. So given that HUD also does allow permanent-to-permanent transfers, this is another way you can think about doing stuff where you get somebody into Raptor housing while you're waiting for permanent supportive housing to come available and use that kind of a flow through. So I think that that's part of what HUD's contemplating in trying to push communities to really focus on their chronically homeless population. But absolutely, this is something that every community is struggling with. Like, wait, how does it actually work in practice? This isn't practical for a lot of the population we're serving and the way our programs are designed. So I think that this is a, just for what it's worth, this is a conversation that every community is struggling with right now.
Yeah, just looking at the mid-year numbers, you know, that sheet, it looks like probably with this, where you're going to rescore, you're going to bump up maybe the King project a little bit, maybe the Boulevard Court a little bit, but you're not going to bump up the rapid rehousing. So that I would assume right now that thinking would be rapid rehousing is going to score low enough that it's not going to get refunded if something isn't going to get refunded, right? Isn't that what we're now assuming? Right? Something's not going to get refunded, looks like it's rapid rehousing. Is that what we want? And if that's what we want, then what does that mean? If it's not what we want, how do we not have it happen, right? I mean, isn't that really what we're talking about at the end of the day today? Which I guess it is. Right? Or we're going to lose a bunch of refugee housing. So.
Yeah, and that could be a resultant effect of this tool. It's hard to tell until it's actually applied. But
didn't you intentionally bump it towards permanent supportive housing?
The performance review committee recognized.
And towards the site.
Correct.
Based,
yeah.
Right. So
there were points.
That leaves rapid rehousing.
Yep.
I mean, you're intending to rapid rehousing.
Okay. So I guess for the purposes of this discussion today, and I think what all of us kind of remember from last year, is that the purpose of us doing this is to make that decision exactly. Like, if we are saying as a community that we're going to lose some rapid rehousing, then what are we going to do about that? You know, how are we going to reallocate that? There's bonus points for reallocation. Are we going to make some decisions about the projects that may be rapid rehousing and that are going to score on the bottom, that are going to end up possibly not getting refunded? What do we do about that money so the community doesn't lose it? Is that what we're supposed to be deciding here? Because I kind of heard you say, wait until the numbers come out in the wash, and that seems a little late based on what happened last year.
So from the perspective of the COC competition, we do need to leave here today with an approved set of tools. So that is our primary objective for today. And I can say that the PRC did really discuss this at length in terms of how is this tool going to affect the projects we have here in Sacramento. And there was a recognized need to support those built projects, given the fact that Sacramento is a very tight rental market, and that programs like Rapid Rehousing have been struggling in terms of locating those units. So in terms of prioritizing this funding and making sure that it can be as effective as possible, this tool would reflect that, to make sure that the dollars that are being spent through the HUD funding stream match what are the community priorities, what are the priorities from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and how those funds are going to be utilized at their highest potential here in Solano County, recognizing Sacramento. Recognizing that we have this very tight rental market need. And so I think that's what the PRC was really talking about in terms of balancing all these.
Can you explain
factors.
Why a tight rental market means no rapid rehousing? Because, or rapid rehousing for harder to house folks? I'm just fearful a little bit that without the gaps analysis, I know ESG funds rapid rehousing. We have removed the local rapid rehousing program, so we've reduced rapid rehousing slots to then probably reduce more rapid rehousing slots. I don't know, I don't have the data, but I'm thinking that's too much. So how does that, your explanation, or maybe again, it's our conversation, and I'm a little nervous that we're not having time to converse amongst ourselves on it, because it's almost 9:30 in a way. So how does, you know, what do we know about the need for rapid rehousing if we agree this is prioritizing permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing for chronically homeless people?
I think the answer to your first part of your question on the rental market is that landlords and property owners are renting to market rate folks, and there's not a need to rent to our folks. And so that's where the problem lies. If we were at 20% vacancy and you had landlords who were incentivized by empty units to rent us, then that's an easier
fix. Well, most of the permanent supportive housing is scattered site, which requires
land. You said rent.
Wait, most of the permanent supportive housing requires landlord participation. And so I think the market doesn't really affect whether we want to do rapid rehousing or permanent supportive housing.
The problem's the same in those two situations.
Yeah.
It does seem that the permanent supportive housing, though, through like master leasing, has more opportunities for success, whereas the rapid rehousing, there's no master leasing component to that.
Based on our data?
HUD rules say that you cannot do a master lease.
Saying we know that they're more successful based on our data of the success of those projects.
They are, yeah. Reason that the rapid rehousing is scoring at the bottom is largely because it's not being used.
And to Cindy's point, I think if anyone on the board would like to weigh in, now is the time. And I'll state the obvious. This, nowhere is there like Fort Beyond where all the children are above average. The nature of ranking means we will have, types of projects or individual projects at the bottom. And we want to weigh the scoring tool and see if it accords with us. But there's no way around the fact that it is a ranking. So if any of the members of the board want to weigh in, this is a good opportunity.
I just wanted to just add that, no matter how we score, whether it's going to be rapid rehousing that's going to end at the bottom or permanent supportive housing, I hear what Aaron was saying, is that I think we need to, whoever's at the bottom, no matter what it is, I think we as a community need to figure out how can we continue to keep those families housed. It doesn't matter if it's rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing, or what it is. I think somebody needs to come up with a way to be addressed that, because we don't want to lose those beds.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the bottom line where I'm missing. Mm-hmm.
I just wrote Joan the same note.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Mike?
Point of clarification to the point that Cindy was making. As I read the scoring on page 3 of the green sheet, for example, project provides permanent supportive housing at a single site location. So you don't get any points if you're a project that is scattered site. This is seemingly attempting to preserve existing single site projects, whether they're
And I was referring to number 3. I understand that prioritization, but the number 3 I was one. The number 3 on. I'm sorry, I printed it out.
It's on this one.
It's on the orange.
Yeah.
Which would actually encourage every project to prioritize chronically homeless, including rapid rehousing. And I think that's an unrealistic thing. People may try to do it. They may want to do it. Try to do it, but. I'm also concerned that rapid rehousing is not going to be funded from the CLC, in addition to then, if it's not, what happens?
Given that we know we don't have enough permanent supportive housing, even though that's the preferred placement for many chronically homeless people, we do have more rapid rehousing. And the turnover in permanent supportive housing is about 12%, right?
10 to 12%.
So there's not that many opportunities to have an appropriate placement for people
And so the question is, are they better off with some type of housing, even though it's not the ideal type for them? Because how many people are on the queue?
What do we got now? We got 2,000.
You know, so it really, in my mind, also boils down to, are we better off housing some people, even though it's not the ideal type for them? Because if we're going to wait for the ideal type for everyone, they're not going to be housed. So I
do agree with that, and I agree with the way the coordinated entry gives people that choice to go to rapid rehousing programs. We absolutely need to give them that. It's just, will we have rapid rehousing for other populations? You know, will we just be relying on ESG for that? It would be good to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously that flow only happens. I mean, a lot of people are not chronically homeless as well. So do we have that tool at the right size for those folks, or are we making the choice, you know, we're not going that route at all?
And our system is primarily targeted chronically homeless. I mean, look at for PSH, it's a threshold of chronically homeless and a threshold of 14 on a loan. And then
let's just do PSH. I mean, why even say rapid rehousing? Let's just do PSH. And I'm not really saying that facetiously. I just think kind of setting up rapid rehousing to do it may not make sense. Like, if really we want to prioritize the right resource, just let's say we're not doing rapid rehousing in this and give them the right resource. Or, yeah.
Isn't there a risk if you lose all your rapid rehousing that you'll actually increase your homelessness? So if you can't house those people who aren't yet chronically homeless, then they're going to stay on the streets and become chronically homeless?
Emily? I'm still new to the board, so I'm still learning all the acronyms, but from what we see, with our youth and folks that come to our center, is we see a lot of folks who, well, we see both. We see chronically homeless, and we see newly folks who are homeless, especially young people. And what we know is that when these kids are runaways or they've been kicked out of their homes, they're so new that they still haven't gotten into all those other, you know, at-risk behaviors, sex trafficking, substance abuse, all sorts of things. And so, for me, it's I think there should be some type of priority for these folks for the folks who aren't chronically homeless, the folks who are new to being homeless. Have a greater chance, a greater outcome, to going back to permanent housing, because there's less, there are less mental health issues, long-term health care issues. These are individuals that are just new to the streets, and so I just wanted to kind of weigh in the importance that, just as you were saying, that if we don't work with newly homeless folks, that they will then become chronically homeless. We have a youth area and an adult group area, and the adults are mostly chronically homeless. And I see the youth looking at them as if they're looking at their future. Mm-hmm. And it's a really sad state for them to see that. So I just kind of wanted to put out that.
Patty and then Ryan. Well, I guess it's pretty clear we need space for chronic homeless. We need space for rapid rehousing, which I look at as somewhat preventing people from becoming chronically homeless. And I think it's pretty clear that we're not going to get it all here. I mean, I think the message that I'm hearing is we can't count on this COC to provide all the housing for our community we need to do a good job that we're doing here. We need to do whatever we can to maximize the dollars we'll get from HUD, because we don't want to leave any on the table. But we also need to recognize that there is a strong need to bring partners into our charge to bring housing. If we are looking at this HUD grant to provide all the housing, we will never get there.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, the number that I look at monthly, we have usually about 1,300 that are self-identifying as crime. And we certainly have to go through a process of vetting and confirm that. But it is a large portion of our population that are long-term chronically homeless individuals. Mm-hmm. So I don't disagree that there are those that are more recently experiencing homelessness, but we need a full spectrum of response, from diversion to referrals into other streams of housing opportunities. And I think for the dollars that we manage from HUD, and John, correct me if I'm wrong, but their expectation is very much that we concentrate on this chronically homeless population. And I certainly don't discount the feedback I hear from providers, because you know better than I, that is a hard population to successfully have some rapid housing. But I mean, respecting the dollars that we're receiving, I think that's more in line with that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That HUD's messaging for the past couple of years has been, we want to shift and target individuals who have been on the street for a significant amount of time with these HUD dollars, in recognition that there are other programs like ESG, CalWORKs HSP, that provide rapid rehousing opportunities as well.
Cindy, and then John, and then I think
so. I think we have to balance. I agree with Patty, and I think Ryan, you've said many times too. It's just I know the list looks that way, but the whole population looks very varied and needs a variety of interventions. So again, it has to do with what the community has. We are just adding 250 units from the county. I believe it's 250. These are going to be focused on chronically homeless, on the hardest to serve, and I believe the whole person care is as well. So we've got to look at the whole thing, and we took away local rapid rehousing. So it may be enough rapid rehousing. I do notice one of them is a youth project. I just have a hard time. I didn't hear this until today, that ACOC is not doing other populations anymore. And that seems like a really big decision. I mean, obviously went to the board and said, let's serve the hardest to serve, as does the whole person care, I believe. But are we ready to say that? I mean,
I don't think the tool really does say that. I think it awards extra points for that. But if you have a really great rapid rehousing program that's meeting all of its objectives, that's doing a great job of serving folks, it's going to do better than a fair number of your PSH. It's just that our rapid rehousing projects that we currently have are not doing as well in serving folks, partly because the market is not there. There just aren't enough units out there for what we have funds available.
Well, and it's probably a more immediate measure for those projects because they're on the market every month, whereas PSH is not on the market every month. So it's really going to impact both the same. I mean, the market's going to impact scattered site PSH the same as RRH. But I do think it will disadvantage because of those 6 points, unless you want your RRH to prioritize chronically homeless only.
It definitely disadvantages them, but it doesn't necessarily knock them out. Somebody who's really knocking their project out for RRH is going to do all right.
John?
Yeah, so I guess we're going to have a gaps analysis before too long, and I hope it's a good quality piece of work. Since we haven't seen it, I don't know if it is or not, so I don't know. I hope it includes looking at the other ways things get funded and talks about other options that we have. A lot of money comes from other places. I think the point's well taken. We want to make sure we maximize that money and focus on whatever HUD's going to fund. I've certainly seen disastrous rapid rehousing outcomes in a lot of situations, very frustrating. And I've also seen people be very successful being rapidly rehoused. And, you know, it's always disappointing to lose a program that does really help some people. But we know we're going to, 15% is going to be below the line, I guess, is the way HUD does it or something, right?
We don't know yet for this year.
Well, I mean,
last year I think that's what it was. But years prior was 5 to 8.
Right. Yeah. So there'll be something anyway that doesn't get refunded. But I think. Yeah. the committee has done a good job of really trying to listen to us. I think they've really, you know, gone an extra month to really think things through. And so I want to move that we adopt this proposal.
Do we need the subrecipients or recipients to abstain on this?
Yes, if you do have a comment.
You're not the motion.
Yeah, and I will make the motion.
Thank you. And the motion is to approve the renewal and new project scoring tools and the review and rank policies. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in
I'm
favor?
Sorry, who is the second?
Me, Beth.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
All in favor? Who's non-conflicted?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstained?
No, there isn't. Oh,
would you raise your hand if you're abstaining? So that can be recorded. Motion carries. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
John, thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for your time. And again, thanks to the PRC. Honestly, I mean, they did a lot of really good work on this and worked really hard to make sure that we got this tool as tailored as possible for Sacramento. So.
And I just like to echo that. I don't know who I am, Sarah and Emily. Was there anybody else on the PRC?
There's quite a few other people, Catherine Tulliott's at Trisites, and some folks from nonprofits.
Yeah, I think it's such a great improvement over the years. I mean, since the past few years and really taking a lot of the comments into consideration. So great job. And thank you also.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does it make sense to have a 5-minute cap-to-cap review that we promised to be here to step to?
So I'm going to admit, I had a family emergency. We did, when we can reconvene the group to talk about from the outcome. Just generally speaking, our message that we carry to our elected officials at the federal level, we've met with support, but there wasn't a lot of, hope for change or new projects. And at the time that we met, they had just approved the current budget so that we didn't lose the dollars that we thought we might. But I still think those dollars are suspect. I mean, I think we need to keep advocating to hold on to those, as well as retaining USICH, because that was at the time also being looked at. So we will continue to review those and advocate on the areas that we did prior. I think some of the best contacts that we made is with the local community. So when we talked about whole person care and what that might look like for outreach, to be able to meet with Jonathan group from Wellspace or Sacramento Covered, you know, to start thinking, how do we reimagine delivering some of these services in a more holistic way where we see, like, if the contract we have with CARES, we have some great outcomes, but because we have this really holistic approach to it. So we have health, mental health, housing is a component of it. So those were some of the better contacts that we made and the progress that we'll make from there. Even rethinking how we do what we do at the Continuum of Care with our 13 or so subcommittees and speeding up into this group, is that realistic? I mean, once we hit this group, the amount of time that we have is not realistic. So to meet with Brian Bedford, a Lyon regional, he is to the bridge between education to employment as we are from homelessness to house. How do they do their system? Getting contacts with Dale Ainsworth out of Sac State, who is a systems thinker around healthcare. Those were the types of contacts, at least for me, that were of most value to the takeaway. And also in that room, you have your healthcare. And you know, at the gala to hear Sutter talk about the $5 million that they're putting up as a match to new government dollars and another $5 million to put up to private investment. Those are absolutely encouraging. And to listen to their street outreach for medical, their street nurse program, that they just internally won their award for. Those were all positive things that you see in Metro Chamber of Commerce going to D.C. talking about homelessness. I think that's a real win for us.
Their outreach was a video to the entire delegation that attended what they call the delegation gala. It's kind of managed to get the video in before the place closed down.
Before the sprinkler system turned on? That was a moment. And as true Sacramentans, we were like, I don't know, I think it'll be over in a minute. Jonathan, is there anything that you would add as far as the debrief? Or Susie, you were a key partner in
the job. I think it's encouraging about the interagency council.
Yep.
I think there was a little more clarity when we were at HUD. Although I just want to say it looks kind of bleak. But they seem to be on their game a little bit more, and they had this like transition kind of concept that more dialed in. But that's about it. I mean, there's still a lot of confusion, and it's just like a lot of smoke over there.
Yeah. We had, in 2 days, we held 16 appointments. Our first day was with all of the agency levels, and then the second day was with all the delegates. And then we met with SAMHSA, and I did listen in on the call, but Aaron was the lead on it. Aaron, did you want to report out on that conversation at all?
Bang your head on the table.
That was a little more frustrating.
Yeah, but I guess I'm a glasses half full kind of person, so I'm just going to look for the sunlight. But the HHS meeting was horrible. I think we can all agree, and that's not the glasses half full portion of my content. They were all brand new. They didn't know what to expect. They were fearful. They couldn't talk about anything at all that was substantive. A lot different than the HUD team, because the HUD team seemed like they had been in their places for a while and they kind of could read the tea leaves better. But we had SAMHSA on the phone, and our specific question that we asked them to meet about was that a lot of the SAMHSA dollars that have come out recently that have to do with homelessness don't align with HUD priorities. So they ask you to do things that you can't possibly do in conjunction with HUD housing, but they ask you to house people with using other resources. So there's this conflict that doesn't seem to be able to get past, and we've spent a lot of time sort of trying to get those SAMHSA dollars and beating our head against the wall for that. So we asked them about that. They basically said that was untrue. And then they agreed to have a follow-up meeting with us, which they did. And in that meeting, they did recognize that it was true and that they had sort of missed the point a little bit in the previous conversation. So the good news about that is they heard us. So that's where I'm hopeful that when you get the opportunity to point that out and they go, "Ooh, we didn't really think about it in that way." One of the things that was required in their last release was that you had to demonstrate abstinence in your substance abuse program, and the community of chronically homeless providers who do substance abuse work know that harm reduction is the model that actually has a chance of working. So we talked about that, and we at least got the chance to say a couple specific things. So in that respect, I think it was worthwhile, because we wouldn't have that opportunity otherwise.
And definitely, there was a ton of work put into this. I mean, just the talking points, it was relentless, and we're all pretty exhausted. McClintock's office was even open to our housing issues. I mean, even their staff were talking about the challenges they have as single parents, and as people who don't make a ton of money living in Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there were clear points of contact. I went with a group of the Heritage Foundation, which was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And even there, they talked about not wanting to block the CMS waivers, which we saw with the whole person care pilot, that that's an effective strategy. So there was some sort of that. And also that our street nurse model, we're probably going to have another one. We're just trying to figure out where. But it has got a lot of traction.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Off note, anybody go see the Roger Waters concert?
I heard about it.
It was cool. Robert's Family Development had their kids on stage. I don't know how they got the call, but they came on there and had their kids on there, like 20 of them. And he, talking about political, you want to get him on this whole HUD thing. Let me tell you, that was amazing. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Center Hospital, for giving us their suite. That was nice.
But I will tell you, this, at times it questioned like value doing this program, but I'm going to say this last one was definitely worth it.
Agreed.
Yeah. And it is something to sit in front of the seat of federal government with a team from the Sacramento, not just Sacramento County, but the region, and having even other cities represented at that table, and the experts. So to be able to sit there and talk from the FQHC and medical field, from mental health, from transition age youth, and down in the weeds to the point, answer questions to those electeds, and to be recognized when we come in the room with HUD to say, Now, we know who you are. We know about Sacramento. We know your numbers, mm-hmm. and they're prepared. They've got highlighted documents of what they can tell us about, like this newer program, a transitional rapid housing mm-hmm. grid. I think that says something about us. It says something about the work that we do and how we're seen at the federal level. I think sometimes we get a little microscopic because we think of ourselves and we're hypercritical, which is, that's a fine, that's, I can work in that space. But it is nice to get that federal level and get knowledge that way. So I thought the program was excellent. We definitely brought home the fact that we are one point in California, and I think we're a testament to the rest of California that this problem is getting worse and not better.
Right.
And it is, we need the assistance from the federal level to get out. And we drove that point home, and mm-hmm. I don't think we held back to that.
Yeah, I think we made the point a lot about the lack of housing, the kind of the question that we've all been talking about. It is disappointing to see the new budget come out with, like, slashing the very few programs that actually provide funding for new housing. But maybe they won't survive because maybe somebody will, you know, have heard the message. So.
Yeah. Any other questions about CAPA-CAP? So this... It happens every year about that same time. It's like what, May, April, May.
April.
If others are interested, want more information about it, let me know. Myself, and then usually, like Jonathan was a co-chair this year, and so was Donald Terry, mayor in Rancho Cordova. He did an excellent job.
He really did.
Yeah. We would love to get other individuals to go with us. And this is a great time now to start thinking about what it is that we want to bring forward. Usually identified four different issues that we want to drive home. But if you're interested, make sure you see all of them.
And we also had a local lobbyist. So we had a...
Yeah, the quality of
the meetings this time was far above what we've had in the past. They really got all the right people on the phone. And it's funny, we met with one department, veteran, I think labor affairs, and Becca Bettis, they've got her on the line. And Becca doesn't even know that we're there. And so... They did a great job of getting all the resources in the room and then nationally online.
Excuse me, I have a going forward question. It may well be my ignorance, so correct me if my hypothesis is wrong. But at some point in the last 6 or 9 months, I gained the impression that if locally funded programs and projects depart from the HUD template of what they prefer and want, that will somehow or other be held against Sacramento in its HUD-funded outcomes. Is that correct or not correct?
John,
yeah, I mean, in brief, the way that the COC competition happens is that you have both your priority listing for all of your projects, which we talked about today, but you also have what's called the consolidated application. And the consolidated application is asking you questions based off of your PIT data, based off of your system performance measures, that's saying, how are you doing in terms of trying to end what are the federal policy priorities regarding persons experiencing homelessness? So, for example, if you do not demonstrate that you are adding permanent supportive housing beds for chronically homeless individuals, that could potentially impact your overall COC application score. Now, why does this matter? Your overall COC application score is what HUD uses to determine how much of your Tier 2 funding you're going to receive. So every single year, for the past, I want to say, 5-ish years now, HUD has split your funding into Tier 1 and Tier 2. They always say that Tier 1 is pretty much secure, but always reserve the right to maybe take a little bit out of it. But Tier 2 is not secure. And the way they determine how they fund Tier 2 is they say, what is your overall COC score? And they go across the country and they just start taking projects off the bottom of Tier 2 based off of that ranking. So it's kind of like you have a list of all the COCs, you start here, you go up, and then if you still need to cut more programs, you go back down to the bottom of the list and keep doing that. So that's how projects that don't necessarily align with HUD's policy priorities could put your COC at risk. Because on top of your overall system performance measures, HUD also looks at what kinds of projects do you have in Tier 2. If you have transitional housing in Tier 2, that receives less points overall than if you have permanent supportive housing or rapid housing in Tier 2. So that can also affect your overall COC score. So, and then again, that puts you at more of a risk to lose those tier two funded projects, which reduces your overall annual renewal demand. And that's a very brief summary of a very complex subject.
I think Mike's asking you this. So we have the County of Sacramento using local funds is going to do programs that have no HUD funding.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And same with City of Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I believe my understanding is most of them will be Housing First. I think Mather Community Campus, if out of general fund, at least Supervisor Natoli made the point that it would be recovery-type housing, so sobriety would be a tipsy requirement. How do those programs that are not connected to our HUD stream affect our application to HUD when it's all taken into consideration?
Right. So HUD will not dock you points if you have projects funded by other funding streams that don't necessarily align with HUD priorities. So that will still be fine. Really, HUD is concerned about if you're using our COC NOFA dollars, they have to be able to support our policy priorities. HUD overall does want you to do things, though, like increase your permanent supportive housing beds. And when we were at the conference in Houston, I think back in February, you know, Norm with HUD basically said, if you're at your limit with PSH in terms of your COC dollars, then you need to look outside of the COC to try to find ways to increase those beds. And so, you know, HUD wants to see that you're increasing that overall housing stock. But if those other programs aren't necessarily housing first or they have other requirements on them, that wouldn't necessarily dock your overall COC score. HUD does want to see that you're moving towards that, but they're not looking at the raw numbers. They're not saying in your entire county, in your geographic region, how many programs don't comport with housing first. That's not a metric that we've seen and don't anticipate seeing.
And our time is up, so okay. We will give David the last word and please
I was just wondering the same context as if we are like with CERN that's gonna be hopefully be funded with other than HUD money, because it does fall in line with what HUD is asking, will that in a roundabout way kind of help the application too? No?
Well, there are narrative responses as part of the consolidated application where you can feature things like that. So I think it doesn't hurt.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you all.
It's never ending.
Well, I guess I'm just kind of like wondering when we're having the conversation that sort of what is the overall picture in Sacramento and how do we meet the needs?
Blow HUD away. You see how hard it is to fix HUD. Well, you guys have a little bit better with your
No, it's not easy. We have problems, and we can't solve them. We're in the same